The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning, and welcome to today's episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Monday, September the 7th, 2026, at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of John Carpenter. The time is 7:44 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Okay, so where do we start with this? We go over to the Wikipedia page for John Carpenter and scroll down to the filmography section. The backdrop to this is the first director that I decided to buy all the films by. I had many, and the ones I didn't have because I wasn't interested in. That was probably 2 or 3 years ago. And what it was I felt I owed him, because I'd found myself listening to a lot of his audio commentaries on his films, and I found them soothing to the extent that many times before I go to bed, I'm listening to them because, I can't listen to any sort of heavy music or anything like that, otherwise I'm wide awake, but something about his voice and what have you, and it kind of gets me ready to drift off, if you like, not in a bored way, but he's just got that sort of, I can't explain it, that was how it happened. And I thought, well, you know, I've got a lot out of this guy's work, not just what I've watched, but also what I've listened to. And it was only when I was watching a Abel Ferreira film, it would have been either, what, King of New York or Bad Lieutenant, they were the only ones that I had, I believe, at the time. And he made the point that as a director, you only get a cut of the takings when they're first at the cinema. So actually buying all these DVDs and Blu-rays of John Carpenter, none of which probably went into his pocket anyway. But that was why I ended up getting all his films. He was the first director to do so. And today I'm going to talk you through them. But rather than stay on the filmography part of the Wikipedia page for John Carpenter, and be aware, there is, I believe, a famous John Carpenter who's very successful at quiz shows in America. So you want the director, not the guy who's good at the quiz shows. But we scroll down to below the filmography, it says recurring collaborators. And the reason that I'm doing that today is that there are three extra films in this section that aren't in the main section. And that is because a couple of them are television films and one of them's a film that he did with other directors. But I want to talk about them too, so we'll go across the recurring collaborators section. So let's start off with 1974, his first film, which was a film much like Scorsese's Who's That Knocking at My Door. It was done when he was a student, or it was a part-time project. You get a bit of money come in, you make a bit more footage, things like that. It was a kind of comedy science fiction movie. It was their answer to things like 2001. You know, it was 1974, so it was many years before Star Wars. And there's some amusing bits in it, like some alien that looks like a pumpkin or a basketball. I think it's probably more supposed to be a basketball because it bounces around and things like that. And some people see it as quite a cult film. I've watched it the once, and I won't be going back to it again. It's not for me, but I'm not everybody. And as I say, many people do like that film. For me, his first serious film was actually Finance. It was 1976. It was Assault on Precinct 13. And it actually got a cinema release over here in the UK, and I know that because the actor Jared Harris was talking to John Carpenter about it on the commentary for the 2010 film The Ward, that is his final film that we'll get to at the end of this broadcast. And he was talking about how him and his brother went to see it up in Hammersmith, I believe, or Kensington, somewhere like that in London, when it came out. Now, that film is described as a cross between... Well, let's go into the plot first. So basically what happens is you've got people in a police station, a combination of police and criminals that are arrested, and they're in the cells in the police station, things like that. And there's a criminal gang outside and they're attacking the police station. And the police have to get together, you know, get the criminals to help them defend their station, because the criminals outside, they're not trying to break these people out. They're trying to kill everyone inside. That's the sort of thing it is. And Carpenter himself described it as a cross between Howard Hawks's Rio Bravo and George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead, although it's not a zombie picture and it's not a Western, okay, but he's arguably saying that there's elements of both. I've not seen Rio Bravo. I probably have seen the George A. Romero film. I don't like zombie films at all, so they're not things that I would go back to. But anyway, it's an interesting story. There's a quite shocking scene where a girl who's buying an ice cream from a ice cream vendor is shot. And Carpenter said at the time when he was doing the audio commentary of it that he wouldn't do that now. He was young, he didn't have children then. And he even makes out when Jared Harris says about what a good film it was, oh, so you like seeing a young girl get shot, which I think was quite unfair to Jared Harris, the way that Carpenter put it, because that's, I don't believe, the reason anyone would watch a film like that. It was an unfortunate scene that he felt he was pushing the envelope and wished he hadn't, and I think it should be best left alone, so maybe I shouldn't have brought it up either. But it's just an anecdote that I remember. So it is that kind of film. It's well done. It's one that I don't go back to that regularly, but it's certainly a film that he said it was thanks to the success of that film, not in America, because it didn't really do anything over there, but in the UK, that helped him get the reputation which now allowed him to do his most famous film, which we'll get to in a minute, which is the third on the list of the recurring collaborators section here on Wikipedia. But the one after it, Someone's Watching Me, that's not in the list of his filmography above, Someone's Watching Me was filmed before but released after. So it was filmed in 1978, but released in November, whereas the other film before it, Halloween, was released in October of 1978, but filmed after Someone's Watching Me. The reason I want to do Someone's Watching Me first is there are elements of it that was used in Halloween, and unfortunately I can't remember exactly what they were, but there were shots that he did that when you see Someone's Watching Me, you can see crop up in Halloween. So Someone's Watching Me is about, the clue is in the title, the Rockwell song is not the theme tune, that didn't come along till 1984, but there is a woman, she moves into an apartment, she suspects she's being watched, she finds that she's being bugged, all these different things. It's almost like that gaslighting thing, but she's sort of aware that's going on, and then other people ridicule them, a bit like the, it's almost a sort of preceding targeted individuals, isn't it, really, that what goes on in that film, and that's what the story's about and how that develops. I don't give everything away in this because I don't want there to be spoilers, but that very much, he said, it set him up for Halloween, which is arguably not just his most famous film, but it really launched a genre. Now, up to that point, we had the video nasties over here in the UK, and the main ones were I Spit on Your Grave, Driller Killer, which was Abel Ferreira, Last House on the Left, which was Wes Craven, and Last House on the Left and I Spit on Your Grave are films that I just don't want to look at again. I think I saw them back at the time. They've got sexual violence, which I really don't like to see at all. And it's not something, when you're a kid and stuff, you're always the video, not, oh, you're not allowed to get them. And so they're the things that you want to get hold of. Wes Craven would go on, in my opinion, to essentially kill the horror genre off with the Scream films, because that became like almost a comedy horror, although it was a sort of, it was a satire of horror films. And it kind of ended horror films in the same way that Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles ended the Western. If you think back to that coming out in, what was it, 74, something like that, I think, Blazing Saddles. That was around the same time as what for me is, Clint, I'm not a Western fan, but Clint Eastwood's The Outlaw Josie Wales, I think, is not just his best film, but one of the best films ever made. And it's a Western that I'm not generally keen on. But the Western, apart from the odd Clint Eastwood film popping up since the mid-70s, like, I don't know, Pale Rider from 1985, I don't believe the Western genre started coming back into mainstream cinema until Clint Eastwood brought it back with Unforgiven, that went on to win Best Director, Best Picture, all these different, I think, supporting actor for Gene Hackman in it. And then following that, you had other big budget Westerns like Tombstone and Wyatt Earp coming out of Hollywood. Well, if we go back to Wes Craven with Scream, when that came out in the 90s, and then you had Scary Movie, you really didn't have a lot going on in the 90s with horror like you did in the 80s when Halloween came along. And the other film I'll quickly mention is Tobe Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which again is actually, it's a sort of film, because it's got such a horrific sounding title, it's not quite as bad as you would think. And there are some elements in there that people might not get, but they are humorous the way that they're done. And that's the difference between a film like that and the film like Last House on the Left, I Spit on Your Grave, that are trying to be as obnoxious as possible. For me, I've seen other Tobe Hooper films, or is it, it's spelt T-O-B-E, but I think it's pronounced Toby. He did the Poltergeist film, which I thought was a good film. But I've seen other films of his like Crocodile, The Toolbox Murders, which was, I think, a remake of another video nasty from the 70s that I never saw, which are weak for me, and that's why I've never looked into his films. And I've never really looked into Wes Craven, because he did launch the Nightmare on Elm Street film, but I believe he only did the first one, then he did New Nightmare at the end. But in the 80s you had this genre going, which was started with Halloween, and then Halloween 2, and then you had a big hiatus until Halloween 4, which followed the Michael Myers story from 2, popped up in 88. But during that period, filling in for that was the Friday the 13th films, which were launched by Wes Craven, but he only directed the first and the last, as I said. Then you had the Friday the 13th films, which ran probably the most consistently all through the 80s. Interestingly, they did try and do some remakes of these films in, I think, 2010 on a big budget scale. It was in the late 2000s, shall we say, from 2000-2010, they did a Nightmare on Elm Street. Didn't work at all, I'm afraid, without Robert Englund, who played Freddy Krueger. Surprisingly, he was a big theatre actor, and he brought that overacting that you some actors bring to the stage to the screen. Marlon Brando, again according to Jared Harris, he said that when you're acting on stage, you have to project yourself to the audience, but on film you just have to think it. And so the likes of a Robert Englund with his really over-the-top Freddy Krueger performance that brings that genre alive to its mad, insane way that he does the things that it takes the nastiness off it. It makes him more of a sort of satirical character doing all these horrible things. It didn't work in the remake. However, in Friday the 13th, the remake there was better than the original films, because what they did was they took the first three films and made them into the remake. And the first Friday the 13th film is not about Jason running around in his hockey mask or what have you. He's not in it at all until something happens at the end, which isn't the Jason you would see in other films. Similarly to 2, Friday the 13th Part 2, it's actually comical, because Jason's actually in that, and he's running around throughout the film with a bag on his head. Okay, it just looks ridiculous. It wasn't until the third film that he got the hockey mask, and I think that the creators of the remake realised how the first two films didn't work, because it had gone on to make, I think, 10 films in the actual original series, something like that. I know there was at least 9, because there was Jason Takes Manhattan was 8, and there was at least one after that, and then you had these things, Freddy versus Jason, and all this sort of stuff. But I really have digressed here. The point I'm trying to make is that that genre all seemed to end when Wes Craven brought the Scream films out in the 90s, and you had the odd Halloween film pop up there, but it wasn't the same as it had been going back to the original stories. They were very different, and it wasn't till, if you like, the Saw franchise came out that the horror genre started to be relaunched. And then that, arguably, the first film was very suspenseful, but then it became a sort of gore fest, not as bad as Hostel, which again has got the nastiness in it that, you know, it's torture porn, which I can't understand that anyone would want to see. Quite frankly, I think you got into things like the Conjuring films, and they started using Ed and Elizabeth Warren. Is it Ed and Elizabeth Warren? I always get his name wrong. But they were the famous ghost hunters who were quite famous, and they decided to build a franchise on them, which was quite interesting, but actually quite scary. And that's when the horror genre, I think, came back. But let's go back to the John Carpenter Wikipedia page onto Halloween. So Halloween, the film, is basically about some child, and I say child, he's only 6 years old. You see him at the start of the film. He kills his sister, unpleasant, but it's not done. It's done in a hazy screen. So the thing about this film is it's all about suspense, and it's not very bloody or gory and things like that, but it is frightening. And someone said once about the Exorcist film, and the reason that it was you couldn't get it in the UK, it was banned, it was because the British Board of Film Censors, the BBFC, to my knowledge, they said they had a real problem with children being shown as being possessed or violent or something like that. And it is a scary image, and it still is today. You can look at something like the Child's Play films, and when you've got Brad Dourif, who's another flamboyant, over-the-top actor type of thing, not saying in a nasty way, that's his style, he's right in your face, doing the voice, there is a comical element to that. So it's not, it seems not as real as these sort of things. But anyway, essentially what happens is he's locked up, and when he becomes an adult, he manages to get out of the mental home. He goes back to the town where he committed that murder and commits more murders. And that's basically the thing. What makes it the film for me is Donald Pleasance's performance. He comes in as his psychiatrist, trying to get hold of him and stop him doing what he's doing and get him locked up again. It launched just a series that only finished with the second lot of remakes in recent years, which I may talk about on a show devoted to that series in the future, so I don't want to get into it too much now. The only one that Carpenter was directly involved in was the first one, but he used to make the point on some of his audio commentaries that anytime a Halloween film came out, he was quite happy because, as he said, another payday for me. The other thing that made the Halloween film stand out from all the other type of horror films is the music that went with it. It was genuinely creepy to the extent that all the remakes have used his theme. And that's something else they've had to license from him. And Carpenter's one of the only filmmakers that I'm aware of who was writing his own music for the films that he directed and wrote. And I think that is another unique characteristic of his that makes the film stronger, that he's able to have that additional feather in his cap, or that's the wrong, it's just an additional element. Having a guy that writes the film, directs it, and can also do the music, he knows what to add to it to make it more dramatic, to make it more scary, things like that. Okay, so then we move on to 1979, Elvis. Now, this is a film I've not seen, okay? So it's the first one of the filmography shows where I'm talking about a film I haven't seen. I would have seen it, but to buy it, it's like 20 quid on DVD or Blu-ray. Second-hand copies, they're obviously very difficult to get, and I have over 800 CDs. Okay, I'm very big into music as well, but I've never been a big Elvis Presley fan, so I don't even have, amongst that, the greatest hits of Elvis Presley, because, you know, I know the songs. Like King Creole's not bad, Blue Suede Shoes not bad, but it's just not ever really been my thing. And I know if, like with Martin Scorsese, if I have to buy a copy of Kundun and The Age of Innocence for a fiver each or something like that secondhand, I'll watch a bit of it, get a bit bored, fast forward through, but I don't I don't want to watch something that I just know I'm not going to like. And that is why I didn't go for the Elvis film. But I have looked it up, and it is very popular with some people, although from what I understand, from what I read, it's not a full biopic. It doesn't, you know, start with the beginning and the end of his lot and finish at the end of his life. It finishes somewhere where I think he's doubting his ability, and then he comes back into some concerts in Vegas, and that's where it ends. Elvis is played by Kurt Russell, I can tell you that. And Kurt Russell, that would be his first collaboration with Carpenter that would go on to quite a few films. Excuse me one second. I hope my throat's not going to act up again like it did in the Scorsese show. I apologise about that. I'll have a quick drink of water. So that was 1979. We move on to 1980, The Fog. Like Halloween, it was produced by Deborah Hill, who was a long-time production partner and partner in real life of John Carpenter. And I never got on with this film. I never found it particularly scary. Tom Atkins was in it. Jamie Lee Curtis came back to do it. Adrian Barbeau was in it. Hal Holbrook was in it. It had some great people in there. I just felt it was a bit of a non-story. Essentially what happens is you've got a very sort of windswept, rainy coastal town with a lighthouse and what have you. And the premise is that the ancestors of some of the people in a town caused a ship to get shipwrecked off the coast for some nefarious reasons. And these people are coming back to get... six of them died, so they're going to come back and get six of their descendants. That's the type of thing. I didn't find it particularly scary. Interestingly, I was watching an extra on the Blu-ray of David Cronenberg's 1982 film Videodrome, and there is a roundtable discussion hosted by Mick Garris with the guy who, John Landis, who had done American Werewolf in London, John Carpenter, who at that time was working on The Thing, and David Cronenberg at that time was working on Videodrome. And they were asked about the topic of censorship, and David Cronenberg said that he didn't believe in censorship at all, shouldn't exist at all, but he did believe that films should be age-restricted. He talked about how one of his films, he went in and there was a woman in there with like a three-year-old child, and he felt that annoyed him. He said that child should, he said it can affect sort of, you know, people need to be ready to see certain things and it should be their own personal choice and things like that. John Carpenter said that because The Fog was given quite a high rating, he claimed that it was a children's film and that was where he always saw it. And that kind of confirmed to me why I never really got into it, because I didn't really find it that scary. But many people regard it as a classic. It was one of the films that was chosen for the deluxe box set with all the postcards and the soundtracks and stuff like that that you paid about £40 for, or I did, in the hope that it might one day be a collector's item, along with 1981's Escape from New York, which was the film that followed that, that we get into now. Kurt Russell returns. This has become a cult film, and it is a great film. The premise to this story is it's set, I think, in 1997, filmed in 1981. It didn't get quite as bad as it was looking back then. But New York had become so violent, according to the forward thinking of the filmmaker, that by 1997, it was had become a prison. And what happened is they just walled it off, and rather than put people in prisons around America, they just drop you in New York and you have to fend for yourself. But you do get the option. You can choose to be euthanized on the way. So if you don't want to go to New York and, you know, forage for yourself and be amongst all these other criminals and hope you can find food to eat and, you know, and avoid any sort of nasty things happening to you, then you can pick euthanization. It sounds like many countries that you can live in the West today, doesn't it? But anyway, I don't wish to digress into that area. So what happens is there's a plane carrying the president that is hijacked by terrorists over New York. He drops out in a little pod, and the aircraft crashes. All the people are dead, but his pod lands in New York. Kurt Russell is a criminal, and he's basically told, you can, you know, either go to jail for the rest of your life, or you can accept this mission, and if you can get the president out alive, with a tape that he's got that's crucial to it, then you can have your freedom. And that is the story. And lots of interesting things happen on the way. It's very good film, something that I will certainly be watching again. I've already watched many times in my life. It's one of the classic John Carpenter films up there. The only classic so far, I would say, is Halloween. Assault on Precinct 13 is good, but I'm not planning to go back to it anytime in the near future. Well, in the future, I don't know. But Halloween and Escape from New York, these are classics. Another film that people would call a classic is The Thing from 1982, which followed Escape from New York. This is Kurt Russell again. They're on some, I think, Arctic substation, some sort of scientific team, and something is sort of possessing people's bodies. It's not a spirit, it seems to be more like an alien, and it seems to be able to kill someone and then replicate their entire bodies. And the only way that they can find it is it can't replicate fillings in teeth. So if you, when a body's been replicated, they can find the fillings or something. It's something weird like that that I recall. Many people regard this an absolute cult classic. It's not a bad film by any stretch of the imagination, but for some reason, the story is just not something that excites me in that genre. And so I've only really ever seen it a couple of times. There is an X-Files episode called Ice from season one, which is, for me, a real sort of based on that film. I don't want to say rip-off, because I think if I watch the two, yeah, they're in a substation. Yes, there's you know, something taking over people, but the general story may be quite different. However, I would prefer to watch that over 42 minutes as an X-Files episode than, you know, the getting on for a couple of hours, I believe, that The Thing is. 1983, Carpenter brought out an adaptation of a Stephen King book called Christine, and it was about a car that was called Christine, and this car has a mind of its own. It's not a particularly nice mind. This is one of the films that I bought to complete my Carpenter collection in the sort of 2 or 3 years ago. I never found the idea of a haunted car to be anything other than amusing. It's not a bad film. After watching it, I actually thought, well, I'm pleased I saw it. It wasn't bad. I think you've got the actor Harry Dean Stanton in it. Never forget the Stanton-Walsh rule that Roger Ebert came out with, that any film that has either Harry Dean Stanton or M. Emmett Walsh in it can never be entirely bad. Well, this isn't a bad film, but whenever... The best way to that I interpret that expression is any film that I've seen either of those two actors in, they do enhance. Obviously, there are some films that... There's a film, I forget what it was, but it was Harry Dean Stanton's only lead role. I think it was a wolf... Oh, no, I can't really go there because I can't... Apart from his very last film, Lucky, it was the only film that he did a lead role in. But I saw it recently and it didn't really gel for me, but so there's the exception that proves the rule. How about that? 1984, we had a film called Starman, and it had, oh great, it's not, it doesn't come up. I know the name, I've got to go in there, I know it as soon as I see it. Jeff Bridges. So Jeff Bridges played a, well, let's have a look at the, well, I'll try, I'd like to have a look at the cover, but it's so small on Wikipedia, even when you open it up, I can't give you the premise of it. Essentially, he's an alien from outer space. He comes down here somehow and ends up in a romantic relationship with somebody, and the authorities come after it, and it's a real non-event. It's probably more fantasy than anything else, and it didn't do particularly well. I don't know if it's a... It's, again, one of these films I didn't think I'd like. I was right. I didn't like it. And I only saw it in the last couple of years, and I've no plans of seeing it again. A bit like 1986's Big Trouble in Little China. This is more of like a fantasy film in which Kurt Russell pops up again, and he ends up in Chinatown and gets involved in all sorts of, you know, action sequences, fights between him and kung fu type people beneath Chinese restaurants and all sorts of stuff. And that's the best way I can really describe it. So let's click on it and see how it's described on Wikipedia. The film tells the story of truck driver Jack Burton, played by Kurt Russell, who helps his friend Wang Chi, played by Dennis Dunn, rescue Wang's green-eyed fiancé from bandits in San Francisco's Chinatown. They go into the mysterious underworld beneath Chinatown, where they face an ancient sorcerer named David Lo Pan, who requires a woman with green eyes to marry him in order to be released from a centuries-old curse. This is not horror or thriller. This is comedy, and it really didn't work for me. 1987, another great film in my opinion, Prince of Darkness. Donald Pleasence returned to his third Carpenter film. I forgot to tell you that obviously he was in Halloween, which I did mention, but he played the president in Escape from New York, and there's some great scenes between him and Isaac Hayes, of all people, who's the head of the criminals over in the in New York, and you never really imagine to see Isaac Hayes and Donald Pleasence acting together, but they do, and they do a great little double act there. But anyway, Prince of Darkness is a very atmospheric film. It's a horror. A group of scientists are brought together by a Catholic priest who has a church, and he's in, I think, in LA somewhere in America. It looks like a deserted church. It actually was a real deserted church they filmed in, certainly for the exteriors. And he's found in the basement some big cylinder full of green liquid going round and round. I know it sounds a bit ridiculous, but that is apparently the devil, okay? And it's starting to get out of its canister. And Prince of Darkness is what that is. I know it sounds silly, but it is a very exciting, very well done film about how these scientists gradually succumb to what's going on. And it's one of his best films. He regards it as second in his Apocalypse trilogy, he calls it. He calls The Thing the first one in the Apocalypse trilogy from 1982. This 1987's Prince of Darkness is the second, and we'll get into the third shortly. 1988, They Live is probably the best known Carpenter film for people who don't really know John Carpenter. It's known as a film. Halloween probably better. But They Live has become a classic, especially amongst people who read things like conspiracy theories, because you've got a guy who he's down on his luck. He's like a labourer working whatever job he can get, and he comes across a pair of sunglasses, and when he looks at things like appetizing, what might be appetizing, a drink or something like that, it says consume when he puts the glasses on, and you might have something else being appetizing, it says obey. And it's like you put these glasses on and you can actually see what things around you really mean. People have approached Carpenter about their ideas of what they mean and tried to pin him down on that. And he said it was just an attack on consumerism in the Reagan era. That was his explanation of the film. Other people think otherwise. For me, the premise of the film is far better than its execution. There is a bit in the film where the lead actor is Roddy Piper, who was a wrestler. Don't believe he really acted before, although he did go on to act afterwards. And he gets involved with the other lead actor, Keith David. And they have a fight, which seems to go on for about 10 minutes. And it's just so inappropriate to the film. It's like a long wrestling bout in an alley. Just goes on for that length of time. And when you listen to the audio commentary on this film by John Carpenter and Roddy Piper, it's one of the few that I don't really listen to, because they end up talking about wrestling a lot, and you can understand why Carpenter not only cast Roddy Piper in this role, but also had this long wrestling sequence in it, because he was talking about how he went to one of these WrestleMania events and met loads of different people. He was obviously a big wrestling fan, and he decided not only to introduce that element into his film, but he wanted one of the wrestlers that he liked to play a role in the film, hence Roddy Piper in this film. So that kind of ruins the story in a way for me. that diversion in the middle. If you were going to watch it and you're enjoying it, then by all means sit through it. But if you get annoyed like me, I would recommend that you fast forward through to the end of the wrestling scene where the story then continues. So we move on to another film that I bought to complete my collection 2 or 3 years ago that I thought would be the one that I would least like. It's called Memoirs of an Invisible Man. And it's marketed as a science fiction black comedy starring Chevy Chase. And the interesting thing here is much has been said of the disputes that Carpenter supposedly had between... I don't think it's ever been necessarily... Well, let's say, here's the final paragraph on the filming section on the Wikipedia page on Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Carpenter would go on to say that the production of the film was very troubling and vigorous. While also battling studio executives, Carpenter claimed Chase and Hannah were the stuff of nightmares and impossible to direct. In particular, Chase would often refuse to wear his special effects makeup and would remove it prematurely, ruining a day's worth of filming. So because Chase becomes invisible in the film, he obviously had to wear certain things that they could use to take certain parts of his body out and leave other parts in, because that's the way it looks on the film. And it is one of the few films also where Carpenter did not do the music. And the other couple of films that are mentioned here, he didn't do the music on The Thing. He brought in Ennio Morricone, and he brought in a guy called Jack Nitzsche to do the music on Starman. But certainly I've neglected telling you about the music to these other films. He did do the music. All his best films he seems to have done the music on. So Halloween, well, he did the music for The Fog, not one of my favourite. Escape from New York, Prince of Darkness he did the music on. But Memoirs of an Invisible Man, I actually enjoyed. I thought it was a good film. For me, Chevy Chase has always been the vacation films. And then the Fletch films were good as well. And of course he was in Caddyshack. He's just been a comedy actor for me. I say just, but he's always very good at playing that role. I've not really seen him in anything else. But in this film, he was good. And it is a film I will watch again at some point. I've only seen it the once. That takes us on to 1993's Body Bags, which is the other film not listed in his filmography above the recurring collaborator section on his Wikipedia page that we're looking at. And that is because, like the New York Stories film that I had to add on to the end of the Martin Scorsese films show I did last in this collection, it's not just directed by him. It's directed by, I think, it's three stories, just like the New York Stories film. But he directs the story, and Toby Hooper of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Poltergeist directs another story. The other interesting thing is with the cast in this film, because he has all these different horror directors coming in as sort of cameos, like Sam Raimi, who I believe is famous for the Evil Dead films that I never got on with. Wes Craven, he pops up in there. I believe even Roger Corman pops up in one of the films, does he? Might be wrong. I thought he was in there somewhere. I can't see him listed here, so maybe I was wrong on that. No, I am right. He was in the film. It's three different segments. Okay, The Gas Station is a classic horror film. Someone supposedly escaped from a prison, or he's some psychopath or what have you, and some woman's on her own at a gas station. There's a lot of scares, fake scares, things like that. It's very well done. And then the second film in the trilogy that makes up Body Bags, it's only a short film overall. I think it comes in at 90 minutes, so it's about half an hour film. It's called Hair, and it's about a guy who's obsessed with, he's losing his hair and he wants to get more hair, and he gets more than he bargained for. And so it's a bit of a strange one. I'll leave it there. And then the final one, some guy who's lost an eye gets an eye transplant. He's really happy to have his eye, but it ends up being the eye of a not very nice person, a serial killer or something, and he ends up seeing all these horrible things from this guy whose eye he has. It reminds me of there was an American serial killer called Gary Gilmore, who famously donated his eyes after he was executed, which actually resulted in a song by a punk band whose name I can't remember now called Gary Gilmore's Eyes. But the main interesting thing about this for me is John Carpenter acts as the coroner in the film, and he plays this guy who looks like a zombie. It's the only time I've seen him act. Sometimes you see him in a film. I think in one of his films you see him in a phone box making a call, something like that. I think he pops up in the fog somewhere in a church. But this is actually a proper speaking part, and he's sort of introducing you. So it's sort of done like a kind of slapstick horror thing, nothing to be taken too seriously. And it's quite interesting to see him in that role. It is a fun film that I would definitely look at again. It cost quite a bit, I think, to get, because it's not available in the UK. I had to get it brought over from America. I think it's on Blu-ray and it's multi-region, so I'm able to play it over here. Okay, so let's go back to the main page that we were on. So 1994... brought In the Mouth of Madness, which is the final film in the Apocalypse trilogy that was started with The Thing of 1982, and then Prince of Darkness of 1987, and then In the Mouth of Madness 1984. I very much doubt when he's making his first film, he realises this is the start of a trilogy, you know, 13 years before when he was doing The Thing. No, what's right, 12 years before. But if the shoe fits, you may as well wear it. And In the Mouth of Madness is another great film. I never liked it initially when I saw it. The lead character is played by Sam Neill, who's always been a very dependable actor for me. Sadly passed away recently. But what the story's about is that he's hired to track down an author who's gone missing called Sutter Kane, who writes these novels that have ended up, when people read them, they go mad. And the whole city's gone mad after reading this Sutter Kane novel. And he's got to find him. And on the way, he ends up in the novel. And it's very bizarre, very strange, but very original and quite exciting. Well worth watching. I would definitely recommend that to go to. 1995... bought a remake of the film Village of the Damned, which is, I think it's a remake. It's based on a 1957 novel. It wasn't very well received. It starred Christopher Reeve in a lead role, and it was the last film that was released before he had his terrible accident in which he was paralysed that happened in 1995. This was released in 1995. But the story here is, it's a very pretty village. In fact, the actor Peter Jason, on the commentary that he did with John Carpenter on Prince of Darkness, he's recounting the films that they did together, and he's been probably the most frequent actor in Carpenter films. I think he's been in 8 of them, starting with They Live or Prince of Darkness. Prince of Darkness, that came first. And he said one of the favourite films that he worked on was Village of the Damned, because they got a late start and an early finish and good food. And that's what a lot of these actors go for. John Carpenter even makes a joke. You know, the first thing they say is, how many days off you got? Where's the catering truck? Things like that. So he enjoyed filming it. It's not a bad film, actually. John Carpenter says that he only did it, I believe, because he had to finish a... it was a contractual obligation, something like that. But I think, as I say, it's worth watching. I'm not sure if I'll go back a second time. The film is about this community. Something happens, something lands from the sky, and suddenly a load of women in the community get pregnant. Unfortunately, some of them, their husbands are working away when they conceived, and so there's obviously causes a lot of consternation there as to the woman's been unfaithful when they haven't. It's just they've been impregnated outside of sexual intercourse. And the children that are subsequently born are not particularly nice. In fact, the tagline at the top of the Village of the Damned poster, I can see it just says, "Beware the children." So that's the film there for you. That takes us on to The Return of Snake Plissken, who was the character that Kurt Russell played in Escape from New York, in 1996's Escape from L.A. Now, a lot of these sequels, it's a sequel. So it's the same sort of premise. I forget who he's rescuing this time, but a lot of people say that this is like a remake, almost scene for scene. But it's still got... It's not done cheaply. For example, he's not got the actors from the original, apart from the Kurt Russell character, but he brought in people like Steve Buscemi. So this guy, you know, at that point, he'd done Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, all sorts of other stuff. So he was a known actor. It wasn't like Carpenter was doing this on the cheap. So it's the same premise as Escape from New York, and it's something that I would definitely go back and watch again. Unlike the film that followed it, 1998, Vampires. Now, I don't like films with zombies, vampires, werewolves, but I saw this one. It had James Woods in it, who I've always enjoyed as an actor. And he's basically a vampire hunter, and he has a crew of people with him, and they go around finding these vampires, hunting them down, and it gets a bit tiresome for me after a while. As vampire films go, if you like them, this is probably one of the best ones that you could look at, because it's very well done, very well filmed, and it's 1998, so it's a lot more modern than, you know, something turns into, Dracula turns into a bat in the, you know, 1930s. It doesn't look particularly realistic, although some people do like the atmosphere. There's even a box set called Monsters, I believe, which had all these sort of Bride of Frankenstein and these films from the 1930s in it that I had for a period of time. And I never watched it, and then I ended up watching it and things like The Creature from the Black Lagoon and all this. I'm sort of, but they just weren't for me. So that went back to a charity shop. But if you like that sort of thing, then that is something you may wish to contemplate. It was followed by John Carpenter's penultimate film in 2001, Ghosts of Mars. Now, I'm not really sure what this is about. It's really odd film. And the premise sounds great. It says, set on a colonised Mars in the 22nd century, the film follows a squad of police officers and a convicted criminal who fight against the residents of a mining colony who have been possessed by the ghosts of the planet's original inhabitants. But I just couldn't make sense of it. And there's nothing about it that I can remember to really tell you that would suck me in. Let's go to the cast. The cast, again, it's not a bad cast. You've got Natasha Henstridge, Ice Cube, obviously gone to be a big actor. Jason Statham, gone on to be an even bigger actor. This is 25 years old now. This is from 2001. Pam Grier, 4 years ago, she'd been doing Jackie Brown with Quentin Tarantino. And then a couple of people here I haven't heard of, Clea DuVall and Joanna Cassidy. But it has got a cult following. And it says here, with critics praising the action sequences, soundtrack and blending of the genres. So just because I don't like it, I'm clearly in a minority here. So, oh, and Peter Jason popped up in this again. As I say, he was the most frequent, according to that list on the Wikipedia page. Let's scroll down. I think he did 8 films. Yeah, the only other one who did 8 films with him was Gary B. Kibbe, but he's a cinematographer rather than an actor. So there's Ghosts of Mars for you. And the final film is The Ward. That came many years later in 2010. And it was John Carpenter's last film. He's not planning to do any more. He does music more. And he actually even played in the UK. He goes on tour playing music from his films and other music that he's written. And he's teamed up with his son. And also the son of a guy from the Kinks, the band. And I think the guy from the Kinks is godfather to his son, or he's godfather to the guy from the Kinks' son, something like that. The three of them, the son of the guy from the Kinks, his son, and John Carpenter himself, I think they go around playing some of his music around the world, which must be quite fun, going to different places and doing that. But this last film, The Ward, it starred Amber Heard, who I think that was one of her first films, certainly first that I'm aware of. I think before that, she popped up in as the love interest of Matthew Gray Goobler in a couple of episodes of Criminal Minds, the television series, which is very good. And that was one of the early series, and that started in 2005. So I would imagine that would have been before The Ward in 2010. So The Ward itself It's about a young woman who is institutionalized in a psychiatric ward and finds herself haunted by the ghost of a former patient. And it's not a bad film. It's quite well done, but it's not one of my favourites. It's worth watching. It didn't do well at the box office, only made half back of what it cost to make. And I think the previous... He was very unlucky with his films, what they were generating financially. If we go to Ghosts of Mars, that got half back of what the budget got, 14 million back on a 28 million budget. So it could be that a combination of him not, John Carpenter not wanting to do it anymore, maybe even struggling with the financing, because the two films he'd made in the 2000s, both of them had only earned back half what they cost to make. But either way, it was worth going through the filmography, and I should have maybe learned more than I did with some of the films that I watched, because the only film that I can think of that I never had an interest in watching was Memoirs of an Invisible Man, and that was actually worth watching, that I bought to complete the set. Body Bags I'd had my eye on, but I always sort of thought, well, you know, it's a bit expensive, isn't it? Gotta pay about 20 quid for it. You don't know if you're gonna like it, something like that. But for me, John Carpenter is a very unique director in the fact that he produces the music for most of his films, and that, as I say, gives him an edge, because music is very integral to horror films. I mean, could you imagine The Exorcist without the Mike Oldfield music to it? Would that work? And I think even Friday the 13th has a certain film tune. It's never, theme tune. It's never been one of my favourites, but there's certain music that really goes with that sort of thing, and probably the most famous of all, Jaws. And John Carpenter actually talks about the John Williams as about horror film music. Some people does music Mickey Mousing, he calls it, da 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 da, like that sort of style. And he said that, and a great example of that is how John Williams did the music for Jaws, but what effective music it was. So that being said, I think that's everything covered. So fortunately, we finished this one quicker than the Martin Scorsese one that went right over an hour. This has gone well under. So what I presented to you today is not the subject I'm best known for, but after having had my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It is not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. You, if you enjoyed this episode, rather, of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get. And in the meantime, thank you for listening, and bye for now.